system. I find you in the shows and moving are great. And being a nerd, the sign system is everywhere you go.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. PJ is stretching out and getting ready for the podcast. Bum, bum, bum.
I got to be limber for the episode. That was a good jingle, by the way.
The quality of the podcast is going up. The jingle's possibly going, dipping a little bit.
I don't know, man. I think your jingle game is legit. That most of the listeners probably don't even know what that song's from, but you and I, who are old as dirt, know where that comes from. And that's all that matters.
Yeah. So welcome back to Design System Office Hours podcast. It's winter almost here, like depending on when this podcast will launch. So like, I got to be very careful about not singing holiday songs. That's my takeaway, my retro item from a few podcasts ago.
It is firmly winter. There was frost on the ground. And as far as I'm concerned, if there's frost on the ground, you are firmly in winter. Because I am from California and I have very tender sensitivity to temperature.
So this is episode, depending on when this goes live, possibly episode 26, and we're in good spirits. We've gotten a lot of great feedback for over the past 20-something episodes from our hundreds of thousands of listeners, and including some hundreds of thousands. Yeah, you got to manifest this this thing. And we've gotten quite a bit of feedback, but then also some good listener questions that we wanted to get to. So wanted to just possibly like, based on what you had suggested, PJ, maybe we just go through some of these and then like give our thoughts on them.
Yeah. Yeah. And full disclosure, we're probably going to say that some questions can't fit within the episode. So we'll just move on and address it in a future episode, but we'll do our darndest to get through all of these.
I could start off with the first one, which might be a non-answer because it seems like a full episode on itself. Accessibility and design systems. So the question here was, how do you ensure and automate parts of the process of checking for accessibility standards, not only in the system, but promoting good best practices across designers on your team?
Yeah, I think that is a full episode. And I think there is an amazing person on our team, Cynthia, who would be great to tell us all how to do it.
Yeah, the easy answer that I've used in the past, so from just a very baseline point of view, is whether using Figma or Sketch or XD, utilizing whatever plugins such as Contrast or Stark App. I just found out today that Stark App started charging money, so I couldn't use that properly. So smirk emoji there. Contrast app might be a better option. You could catch that in Figma or catch the iOS app, or not iOS, the Mac app as well. And trying to see from just like the basic point of view, checking things as simple as type size, color contrast, at least getting that in your process and getting other designers to do the same. I think that's a tough question, especially given the fact that a lot of folks like to move fast and may not see this as part of their process. You might want to just sell them on the idea that it's something that if you do on a routine basis or you utilize the system, may be baked in. So that's the typical message that we usually give.
Yeah. For me personally, I think step one is giving a shit about it. Not being an expert. One cannot be an expert in everything. So if you don't know a ton about accessibility, you can either learn about it, of course, or you can hire folks that do understand it. I think that is totally okay to say, you know what, I'm never going to have all the knowledge I need. We are very limited, finite entities. Acknowledge that and hire the folks that can do it. When I was a manager a while back, it was abundantly clear, I did not have the understanding that was necessary for accessibility. So we hired some folks that had amazing accessibility chops, and Lordy, have they done miracles on our team. And so, and one of their core skills among many is that they genuinely care about accessibility, and that propagates through everything that they do. And so just caring about it, I think, is a great first step, because that's going to be the ignition for everything else moving forward.
Yeah, I would argue that if you want to move fast, possibly as system maintainers and designers, being able to showcase how to do it effectively and quickly and do the baseline, like we said. But I think hiring a consultancy to do this or a service is okay. I would see it as a design system physical, possibly doing it annually, or maybe, you know,
got it,
twice a year. But if you see it in that sort of way, and really getting an understanding of the baseline of where you're at now and where you need to be, you could at least plan ahead and put milestones in place for how to fix these sorts of things.
Yep. To be continued. Gotta have an episode about this.
To be continued.
I think it'd be a
next
good one.
One is design system audit. Let's talk about how might you perform an audit? What would you audit? Would you audit the live app? Would you audit the code base if you are in using Storybook? Would you do that? Would you audit a reference site? Vice versa, how would you document and showcase the outcomes of this? Would you focus more on the UI, UX portion of this, or the code front-end side of this, accessibility side, et cetera?
Great question. What do you think?
This is like a non-answer as well, but it depends on where you're at, right? So if you were in a place like you and I had discussed, privately, in terms of iconography, if we wanted to audit our iconography and possibly use like a new set of icons, where do we start? Well, fortunately or unfortunately, we have something in place already. So that's like instantly tells us that there is some sort of design debt in place. Let's really try to go in. I would audit the code base. So audit and see all the instances of said thing. So in this case, icons. And then vice versa, go into the libraries, go into the Figma files and do the same thing. And then the joke, you and I have joked about this, like some of our work is in Figma, a lot of our work is in Google Sheets. So this is a very much a Google Sheets type thing. You could do this in Notion, you could do this in, you know, Jira, but Google Sheets works very well for this sorts of thing. And I've actually found great success with collaborating with engineers just utilizing a spreadsheet. Like it's something that it's so simple, doesn't have much interface in terms of the audit. It's checking values.
Yep. Yep. I'd say a little bit of A, a little bit of B. Depends on what you're trying to audit. If you're trying to audit how many instances of a specific icon are you looking for, please do not look through the app to do that. For the love of God, do not do that. Have that. Look through the code base, especially our team has telemetry where we can say like how many components with this specific prop value are being used. Please do that, because the other way is just a recipe to lose your mind. If you're looking for just general consistency of the experience, then yeah, code isn't going to tell you that. You're going to have to look through the app. It's going to not be fun. But typically there isn't going to be a better way than to just look through the experience, because at the end of the day, production is what matters. Figma designs ultimately don't, if you're talking about a customer's experience. So you typically need one or the other depending on what you're looking for.
Yeah, the design artifacts should represent a point in time. Whether they are an accurate point in time, that remains to be seen. You know, like as soon as you deliver a design artifact, unfortunately, it becomes stale, right? The day you hit merge and you announce it and you're very excited about it, it becomes a little bit out of date. And little by little, you have to come back to it. So
also, oftentimes design represents an aspirational vision that doesn't end up being what it looks like when it hits production. it just like there's implementation challenges or the engineer wasn't able to build it that way or who knows, but oftentimes what you see in Figma ain't what you end up with in production. And I think it's just important to acknowledge that and bias towards what you see in production.
I'm going to ask you a dumb question that I've probably asked you before. I'm going to pause to see. And so does Gestalt primarily support the consumer side of Pinterest or consumer and business or enterprise?
Consumer and business. Our goal is everything, baby. The whole kit and caboodle. Right now it's consumer and business, but there's all sorts of things like internal tools, you know, brand marketing. Our goal, you know, if everyone is bought into it, is email. There's another one, right? Like, is to cover everything and to take a unified, singular point of view as to how all those things fit together. But right now, it's just monetization and consumer.
Yeah, I asked that because my use case is a little different, where my org, the business monetization side, is separate from core Facebook app or Instagram app or WhatsApp. So each one of us may have the same taxonomy, but we may do things a little differently. In this case, and in possibly your case, I would say try to audit and see how people are doing them in different brands. And you may be able to see different efficiencies that someone else has found that you have not found yet. And that's a good opportunity to ask to refactor or utilize a component that may be more up to date.
Totes.
This is a sticky one. Governance. How do you ensure designers are showing practitioners of design systems everything before they hand off to devs? Is this something you do? Do you QA the components, templates, pages, files? How do you do?
We don't. And this is an evolving conversation. We want to be more involved without becoming a bottleneck. So we're trying to figure out what that could look like. How could we review without injecting a laborious process? And we have some ideas, but it would require additional tooling. It would require additional process, additional expectations. And so we're not quite there yet, just honestly.
Let me give two flavors of this. One might be a better answer and one might be the scary answer. So let's go with the better answer first and then we'll go with the scary answer. So the better answer is if you had a rigid process that is very well defined, much like we had tried to push at Dizzy Streaming, you can review most things. And you review most things not in a you hand off to me, I review it, I rubber stamp this. You could go review it in something, as I say, more casual, either it's asynchronous, you could tap me to branch review, we could review this in office hours, or we could review this with an engineer in just a cross-functional meeting. And that would allow us at that scale of 50-ish designers to really try to get ahead of things and really try to tie patterns to each other. And if we see someone that's working on something that is similar, that may be a little more evolved, we would promote the designers to collaborate with each other. So that's the best case scenario and a more rigid process. Unfortunately, that does not work where I am. There's too many designers. There's hundreds. Org-wide, there's over 1,000 designers, but there's hundreds of designers, hundreds of engineers. We cannot be in the business of oversight and reviewing everything that goes out and everything that ships. But we do have a process in place where we are supposed to provide feedback prior to handoff through a, I guess it's an approval process. I guess it's a FYI. It's a governance process. There's some crazy astronomical number of hours that we spent as a team last half, like supporting this. I think it was 150 hours reviewing, just reviewing work, providing feedback. And like we were able to bear that load because we have design on call. Designers rotate, our team of 9 designers rotate on call, and they do that for a week. And they are solely in charge of, for now, answering those requests and through that portal. I always thought in terms of a governance process, it's crazy that there's no notion of code reviews for design. Design is able to, by any means necessary, present up to leadership, and leadership will buy in on all of the wacky ideas that may or may not be feasible. And I'm imagining on the engineering side, they wouldn't be able to do that. There's some sort of checks and balances, code review from either your peers, your team, your managers, et cetera. So I think in the perfect world, we'd be doing something like that. Maybe something that's more light, like branch reviews. But Figma doesn't do branches really all that well. But there should be some sort of either asynchronous review or commenting in you know, your counterpart's files that could be of use.
Where I would like to land is that we're able to see high value designs. Not that every design is valuable, but you know what I mean? Where these are strategically critical initiatives and we want to focus in on those ones so that we can give that the attention, as opposed to every single thing that goes out the door. That can be difficult in and of itself to determine which ones to focus on. But I just don't see a world where our team, given the scale that we're at, could realistically review every single iteration of every single design before it goes out the door. And the problem is, you don't want to have it at the end of the design process, because then, man, like, okay, do it all over. That's not an option. You got to see these things early so you can influence it before the cement hardens. And so acknowledging that and finding a way to just focus on the most critical things is what I'm trying to figure out a solution for.
It's coming back to me. I've given this talk before, and if we say early and often, that means you're not collaborating with your partners. But it should be in a micro or macro agile process where you work with design, you spike what they need to be done and see what is the level of effort if I add this to the system as a variant, talk to engineering, let's jam back, you know, let's jam on it and let's regroup in a week or so and then see where we're at. And being able to be comfortable or being able to take on that risk of this spiking work that may or may not be produced, I think is okay. It goes back to agile, which we do want to talk about also in the future. But being able to work with designers on a one-on-one basis, I think at my scale now, I would prefer to do that versus being reactive and reviewing work at the end of the process.
Yeah, totally.
Let's see. Why don't you grab a question, PJ, here?
All right. I'm afraid to even touch my computer since it dropped us off the call the last time. All right. But I'm going to do it anyways, and we can edit this out. I know you have an episode about documentation, but I think this topic is so broad that I would love to hear if you do documentation of the design process. For example, decision-making from the design system office hours. Why did you decide to go X route? What was the problem before? Did you create a new component, or did you decide to do a variant of an existing component? Is that variant going to development, or is it going to be local on only local on the Figma library? All right. So I think if I understand this question correctly, it's how are you documenting the decisions that you've made and making it clear to your audience, to your customers? So what we do, my 3-year-old self is laughing right now, is we have office hours notes. And so every decision that we make, every bit of feedback that we provide, we document so that we have a running tally of the decisions that we make. You bring up a great point. The next big step is finding a way to inject that into the documentation of, here's how we got to this point, here's why it is what it is, and this is kind of the history of this component. That would be lovely. You know, if anything, I'd like to focus in on, like, here's the research that we've done that has led us to this decision, to where we have a high degree of confidence that this is the most effective component that we could possibly make.
That's a tough one, because that's also creating a lot of maintenance work. I had this conversation yesterday about, we were doing a card sorting exercise about our documentation site. And we had a designer that gave us feedback that they didn't understand what the status page was. And I didn't give the answer because we were in a card sorting exercise, but a status page or a release notes page is supposed to be, you know, more or less like a table, I would imagine, that showcases the status of each component, what may need to be updated, what is out of date, what might have passed accessibility, what might need more work. That's easy to manage because that's a list. Now, we got feedback that why don't you put the statuses on each one of the pages individually? Yes, that seems like a great idea. But if we were to have to do that each time we update a component based on either text properties or any other thing that might be a little more minor, I can't imagine, similar to like the 150 support hours that we put in, I don't know how that we could manage this like without automation.
Yeah. I can imagine because we do it and we forget to update. This is something that happens is that we have status on the components. It's a great addition. Kate and Alberto, who are the people that worked on it and shipped it, did an amazing job. But the challenge there is remembering to update the thing when you update the thing. And that is a constant anxiety. They're like, oh, did we update status? Because that's yet another checkbox that you got to check in your process. And so that is something to consider is, do you want to take on the weight of keeping that status up? We've made the decision, yes, in this case, but it is an investment that you're going to be making and another thing that you have to remember to do at the end of the day.
Yeah. Let's skip to the one after this one, about documentation.
Oh, I'll do another one. Okay. You can over-document. Can you? Designers are busy and they aren't reading our long ass articles. I love this question already. I once had a designer on my team say, well, they have to read it. It's their job. Well, they aren't. So thinking that this is the best. Thinking that that way is just setting up designers to fail. Can we solve problems with less friction, like AI that lints designers' files and makes recommendations? I don't know. You want to start? You start off on this one, Davey.
Yeah. So this was from a friend of the program, Cal. And so at Meta, we do have a plugin that lints the files, but that also needs good actors to utilize this. So they do need to go up to the flyout menu, go to approved plugins, run the plugin. It's a lot of work, right, PJ, to do that.
Those buttons don't press themselves, David.
they don't press themselves. But if you do this, which we do have trainings for, like, you know, when we start as product designers here, you're saving yourself dozens of clicks having to check individual text boxes and frames to ensure that your stuff maps to tokens or styles or what have you.
Yeah, I do think I am a big believer in documentation. It's one of the few things I'm willing to die on the hill for. You know, I think one thing we've tried to work on and we're getting better at it is instead of writing long ass articles, let's write medium ass articles or short ass articles. How can we make it as succinct as possible? I have no doubt there's someone at Pinterest snickering because it's not as succinct as it can be. But how can we continually make our documentation as abbreviated and calorie rich as possible? Calorie dense? Yeah, calorie dense as possible. So that they're getting as much as possible with reading as little as possible. Another way to do this, though, is if you have a highly opinionated design system where you're not throwing a ton of options and variants to where you have to read volumes of documentation or guidelines to make sure you're using it right. That's another way around this. And that's why I'm a big believer in hyper opinionated, hyper distilled and simple design systems, because then it requires less learning because it just kind of does the thing. It's much more straightforward. So I think there's a couple ways to go about that. It's a two-way street. Make short ass documentation when possible so that you have some level of reasonability, if that's a word, that designers and engineers can read your documentation, because it is important to understand how to use the thing correctly. Because if theoretically, if those guidelines really do matter, designers are ultimately setting up users to fail if the component isn't being used correctly.
I have a continuation of this, which is, what if your designers are less familiar with the tools in your toolkit? So whether that's Figma or Framer or, you know, Proto.io, Proto.py, like, what is the responsibility and the onus of the design system team to have basic app knowledge, how to use auto layout, how to create prototypes? What is our responsibility in this? Do we need to, you know, document the law of proximity? That's the question.
Well, so more pragmatically, if no one else is doing it and your ass is on the line, if ultimately it's gonna mean adoption or non-adoption, I say it is the design team's responsibility, the design system team responsibility. Hopefully there's educational material with design ops and also design teams. It's just through continual education. But that at the end of the day, if what is keeping your design system from being adopted, if Figma knowledge is that barrier, I would say address it if no one else is. Cause like at the end of the day, you need people to use your system full stop. And you need to address the problems that are getting in the way. Why don't you pick one?
Yeah, the next one's good. Being realistic about utilizing things that are not homemade and partial adoption. So being able to hook into something that already exists, whether it's like an open source resource or paid resource to ship things like maybe chatbots or DataViz or other things that our design system teams may not be able to build, you know, in reasonably within a half. Leadership loves it because it increases velocity, you know, at times. And it's something that just works out of the box. Maybe you just skin the thing, you know, but these plugins, libraries aren't going to be using or leveraging our components and our primitives, our tokens. And is this okay as a possible solution? Is this a little bit short-sighted based on, you know, longer-term thinking? How about offering tokens or something that is like more cohesive?
So basically, I think it depends on what the goals of your design system are and if you're going to net positive by making that decision. You know, sometimes if you need to see some short-term wins to get the investment that you need, accruing that debt is going to make sense. I just think there has to be some critical thinking for every specific situation. I'm not a big fan of design system services where they, you know, it takes all your data and it does everything for you. But that's because we had documentation already built. There's a lot of reasons why it didn't make sense for us. But if I'm like a design systems team of one, it's going to make a hell of a lot more sense. And so I think it's just assessing every single situation and understanding how that fits within the long-term goals that you're heading and not taking a dogmatic approach to whether you should adopt something or not.
Yeah. Maybe even if you're a small or medium size, and I would hate to think that our advice is mainly for large company designers, people that, you know, like in big, large ad-based businesses like ours, because we didn't come from that. And so we've seen the smaller scale of this. We've seen the medium scale. I'm in a boat where I see this larger scale where some of our leaders, our engineering leaders, our product leaders may not want us to utilize services because they think that it's more beneficial to build it in-house and build it in-house so we have control over whatever tool this is. So the token pipeline is a good example. Like I think my head started spinning when you were mentioning that there's services that handle design token integration into Figma or into code and do this for you. I found them to be extremely valuable in theory. I haven't had the chance to use them because my companies have not allowed us to tap in or have them tap into our GitHub to do this.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of us are probably using a outside tool called React, right? Like, so we're all doing it. It's just a matter of how you do it, when you do it, why you do it.
Yeah, and it might also just be based on like InfoSec concerns, how much control you have over it. So if you're able to fork something like Figma tokens and then just run it locally, maybe you get that approved, right?
Totes. Yeah. I was putting the thumbs up, which everyone could obviously hear. You want to do one more question?
Yeah. Yeah. So let's see. I want to talk about this one. I do want to have a separate episode on this because there's a huge space to talk about this stuff, given the situation that designers are in right now. So hiring and interviewing design systems people, how can that be different than interviewing design journalists or product designers? So myself, we had to do whiteboarding exercises. We had to demonstrate product acumen. But I'm paraphrasing the question here a little bit. We're not necessarily product designers. We are system designers. Some of us may have been product designers in the past, but our roles and responsibilities are different. And how would you interview and what would you look for if you had the bandwidth to interview people and hire someone today?
The first question I always asked, whether it was good or bad, I'll just tell you what I've done, is I'd ask about their point of view on systems. What are the principles that you use that drive your thinking around systems? Because so much of systems is about thinking through the whole system, like the pillars of thinking that drive your decision making process. And so that's where I would try to really assess, like, A, are they thinking? Do they have a philosophy? Because I think having a point of view on systems is really critical. And then secondly, is that point of view not like, do I agree with everything, but is it going to be compatible with the direction that we're going? We do have differing opinions with the team. It's awesome. We love it. But we want to make sure that those differing opinions are symbiotic, not just like, we all don't like each other, like don't agree at all. I have no common ground. And so that's where I would usually start. And that was typically, I'd start there because that was the most, for me at least, that was the most critical question that I'd like to get through, that they've put the time to think about how systems work, how they go about it, what their mindset is about how they make decisions. Because if they, you know, I would argue if they're taking a non-systems mindset towards designing a system, it's like, oh, I just make a decision, an arbitrary decision for every single thing that comes up, that's probably not going to end up systematic. So I'd always wanted to understand how they went about the problem solving process.
Yeah, this goes back to one of the earlier questions about this creating one-off designs and patterns. And I guess it wouldn't be called a pattern if it was a one-off thing, but that's besides the point. I would try to interview or do a design exercise that is trying to tease something like that out. And the typical UX design challenge may not fit the bill. But like you mentioned, we have designers of all capabilities and different specialties. So you might not necessarily be interviewing people that will just do design engineering, that would code, or you might not be interviewing people that are strictly just really good at creating components, but maybe you're interviewing people that have a little bit of product sense, so they could write product requirements and write documentation. Maybe you're interviewing people that are better at public speaking and getting out there and maybe handling communications amongst your team, or maybe from like an educational standpoint as well. So really trying to tease the different pillars of design systems out, I think would be, in our case, the general meta and even Disney streaming product designer interview. I would be able to see if they were a good person because I would look for very specific nuanced things, but for anyone else that's just coming into interview, I don't think that it sheds the best light for systems thinkers.
No, in some regards, I think it, you know, at a lot of companies, the typical design interview loop is going to be problematic for a system designer. It's a challenge, right? So it's tough because they are different skills in many regards. Not that there aren't plenty of product designers that become systems designers, and so they can speak the language and have that lingo. But oftentimes those skills are divergent, and so I think it's worthwhile having a different interview approach towards system designers.
It might even be set up less as a design exercise straight up, but more of a workshop. So maybe it's part of a hypothetical audit. So it doesn't need to be an audit of our system, but pull some different components out and really try to compare and really see if you could weave the string through the needle there and see if you could connect the dots there. I think that would be more practical than a strict design exercise.
Yeah. Design exercises that's another thing altogether. I think it attracts a certain type of designer. And I think it can really be brutal for someone that likes to think a little bit more, you know, like, yeah, I want to think on that a little bit. Well, you're not really able to. It's like, no, baby, you're going to do this on the fly. And some people are comfortable with that. Some people aren't, but I think both skills can be very effective in a design org.
I'll mention this. Hopefully I won't get in trouble for this one. So part of our interview process is also a app critique. So you would open up an app. So let's open up Pinterest. I should have suggested that because it's a popular app. Let's open up Pinterest and, like, you know, take Don't a dump on it.
Leave us out of this.
Let's open
man.
Up Disney Plus and take a dump on it. Let's take a look at Disney Plus and take a dump on it. But let's open an app and walk through and evaluate an experience. Now, what I would probably point out, like, let's use Disney, for example, would be, oh, there seems to be a lot of consistency with typography. There's not a lot of different type levels going on. I see they were very conscious about this. I'm not sure how that would be received in a interview panel if I was just talking about typography and consistency of colors and buttons.
Yeah, no, man, it's tough to assess a system within a product without knowing the insides and outs. That's tough, man. Like I have no problem with app critiques, but again, that is a person that is very comfortable thinking on the fly and just saying what's on their mind. You know, we've worked with folks, like, you ask them a question. Well, it depends. Like, they need to think about the thing, and it takes them a while to put their thoughts together. And those are they're very talented people that do very talented things that work that way. And I just, we're going off on a tangent, but, like, I am the kind of guy, I'm like, sure, I'll throw anything out there. I don't care. And I think to some degree that gives me a bit of an advantage unless I just, you know, galactically screw up, but I'm not afraid of just like, oh, I try this and I try that. But for folks that aren't comfortable doing that, it penalizes them. But we're way astray from design systems. So.
Yeah. So, like, I believe we've hit over 30 minutes of listener questions from our hundreds of thousands of listeners on Spotify and Apple and Google.
I should give a shout out to Chayla, who gave the first round of questions. Those are all from her. So thank you very much for sending us questions.
Yeah. Thanks to Chayla and Kyle. And if you have any other questions, in fact, if you're a Spotify user, I set up a poll. PJ will never see it because he doesn't use Spotify, but I set up a poll to solicit feedback on what you might want to hear more
PJ
about.
Doesn't use fill in the blank, and it's pretty much every social platform.
PJ doesn't read.
I'm a Luddite. I just sit in a room and look at walls, and that's about it.
PJ sits in a room and waters plants all day.
You're not far off, Davey. Well, thank you, man. This was fun.
Yeah, this is a good one. Thank you so much, and hope you enjoy the podcaster answers to your listener questions.
See you.